From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with two local authors, Sydney Lee and James Kachalka, who have collaborated on a book called The Exquisite Triumph of Worm Boy, published by Word Galaxy. By coincidence, they're both former Vermont laureates. Sydney Lee was our poet laureate for the state of Vermont, and James Kachalka was our cartoon laureate, the first for the state of Vermont. James Kachalka is the author and illustrator of more than 40 graphic novels. He has won 2 Eisner Awards, 1 Harvey Award, and 4 Ignatz Awards. In 2011, as I said, he was named the first cartoonist laureate of Vermont. He also has a separate career as a rock star, performing with his band James Kachalka Superstar. In 2007, Rolling Stone named his song Britney's Silver Can one of the 100 best songs of the year. Sydney Lee, founding editor of the New England Review, is the author of 13 volumes of poetry, most recently Here, a former Vermont poet laureate, and a Pulitzer finalist. He has also published a novel, a collection of literary criticism, and 4 volumes of personal essays. Illustrator and graphic novelist James Kachalka brings us a thematic collection of drawings that chronicle the exploits of a worm who embarks on an adventure of rescue, fueled by inescapable surges of bravery. This odyssey is versified into an ekphrastic epic by former Vermont poet laureate Sydney Lee. I spoke to James Kachalka and Sydney Lee together on Zoom a few days ago. I hope you enjoy our conversation. I know you have collaborated before. I remember going to a thing at the Black Box Theater that was a collaboration between the two of you. So I wondered if you can talk a little bit about how you came to start working together and previous collaborations, and then how this book came to be.
The way we started working together, first, we've known each other for a long time because I'm friends with Sid's son, Creston.
Creston, okay.
And, yeah, and Creston Lee plays in my band, James Kachalka Superstar. So I would go to Sid's poetry readings when he did them in town at Crow Bookshop. And, he's obviously a huge talent. I was named the first cartoonist laureate of Vermont, and Sid was named the poet laureate of Vermont. And it seems like we just had to do something together.
Great. I'm the only person in this conversation who's not been a laureate yet. I'm just waiting for my turn. They're not sure what they'll give me.
James, when I read of the Crow, James did a little cartoon, and it showed him in the audience with his typical sort of caricatured bucktooth American elf figure. And I was up, a bearded guy at the lectern, and he said, "Two laureates in one room, it's a wonder the place didn't explode." But I correct me if I'm wrong, James. It seems to me that James Sturm at the Cartoon Center in White River Junction Alex Aldrich kind of got together and said, "Well, why not get these guys to collaborate?" I don't think they knew that
They didn't know we already knew each other. That's right. Yeah, I guess they asked us to collaborate together. You're right, and they printed up, like a ash can of our first collaboration, which we called Double Laureate Team Up, which is a real comics name. It's not a very Poetry Saturday, but it's a real comic sounding name, because there's like the old classic comics. There's like there was Marvel 2-in-1 or Marvel Team Up. Well, I can't remember the exact titles, but something like that.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So or they would do stuff like, Marvel and DC would put their like best characters together, like Spider-Man and Superman would be in one book together as like a special event. So it was like a that kind of comics special event.
And now they do that with opinion. the
Now they do that with the blockbuster movies, but that's just mainly to earn a living in Hollywood, I think.
Yeah.
But I'm sure Worm Boy's movie will be coming soon.
And then what's the Vermont Arts Organization called?
Vermont Arts Council.
Yeah, they paid to make our pamphlet and gave copies to everybody in the state legislature.
Oh, okay. All right.
So that's how it started.
Okay. And that's the original collaboration. But what about this book? Did you decide to do this? No, that was the follow-on question.
Yeah. This book we just decided on our own. I actually, Sid would send me emails every so often saying, do you want to do something again sometime? And I really wanted to do something big. I wanted to do like a book rather than, we had done a bunch of shorts. Some we did for 7 days, some we did for that Arts Council thing.
I think what's interesting is when I was first approached and it was suggested that I collaborate with James, I said, well, poetry and cartoons, it just didn't make sense. But as James has said subsequently, you know, every art has something in common with every other art. And the more I thought about it, the more I liked the idea, because I liked James himself and I loved his work. And so my assumption was that I would send a poem and then he would, as it were, illustrate it.
Which is what we did with the first
one. And we did that originally. But then it became much more interesting, I think, to both of us. And he sent us a bunch of his wacky drawings. And then I had to look at them and invent the narrative, which hopefully connected all the drawings. And, you know, a worm with a baby's head. it's not, not the first thing that popped to mind when I sit at my desk, but it's been really a challenge and an absolute.
I think he's a little old. I think he's older than a baby, but that's okay. Your interpretation is fine.
he has a lot of hair for a baby.
Yeah.
Stand corrected.
So there is when I send the drawings to, with Worm Boy is, what is it? 102 pages. So it's like, I did 51 pages of silent comics. Like wordless comics. Oh, there might be some sound effects. And then he wrote 51 pages of verse. So a page of verse for each page of the comics. And if you are a non-reader, you can follow the narrative completely in my comic. And what's interesting about his verse is it's very much the verse of someone reading the book. So it's like an epic poem about reading this wordless graphic novel.
Right. Well, it's interesting.
Which retells the story of the graphic novel, but with a lot of artistic interpretation of what the reader is feeling while he reads the wordless graphic novel. He's like an omniscient. Observer, right? So he's observing Worm Boy living his adventure and commenting on it.
It's great that, so it opens, let's pretend that we are gods for this brief instant. And now that you've mentioned that it's sort of like somebody is narrating what they see, I kind of like that even better now. Like, I like
really
being gods and putting words to these pictures. It's very cool. Sid, I wanted to ask you, did you find it freeing to work with comics? Did you feel like you could be a little more playful and let go a little more? Or am I simplifying something?
No, when I write a poem or almost anything, you know, I don't know where the hell it's going. I sit down and I start and then I find out where it's going to go. It was really in a curious way. It was similar here. I mind you, when we pretend that we're gods, the pretense has to be emphasized. And then I found that, once I looked at the Worm Boy emerging from his den, with the light, that I don't want to say it wrote itself, but the narrative seemed to impel itself. I didn't have to stop and say, now what the heck am I going to do with the next panel? You know, it was absolutely delightful, and yes, it was freeing in the sense that I think it.
Well, I think once you began, once you began, you had no trouble. Before you began, you were terrified for months.
I was very daunted, yes. You're not supposed to say that, but it's true. Yes, absolutely.
But that's the way it always is, right?
I've always been, since we started this process of James sending the drawings first and my reacting to them, I've always been daunted. You know, what the heck can I possibly do with this guy, you know, climbing out of his burrow after some queer sort of hibernation, and then being struck with delight to see his two friends. What can I possibly do with that? But then once I pretended that I was a god, then I was off and running somehow.
You know, the first time I read, I'm sorry, James, I'm just going to, the first time I read the book, I didn't pick up on the gods thing as much. And then I read it again and again, I read it a few times. And the first time I read it, I wondered if you were drawing on any ancient texts, you know, is this got to do with Homer?
Well, there was a part he cut out, we cut out where he did talk about a lot of other you know, mythic and epic tales. But it was such a long section, it didn't fit on the page. So we had to make some adjustments.
But
I think in the back of my mind, and I think of it somewhat as a mock epic. But I had all that education. I read all the classics. I read Milton. I read the Fairy Queen, what have you. So yes, that was very much echoing in the back of my mind, but, James rightly. Shut up a minute.
Okay. Well, you're about to say what I thought, so I thought I'd
let me put that another way. I want to say right in public that I think James is a genius. I really do. Aww. Because I've published 23 books, and I've never had a better poetry editor than James. I mean, I would have. If I didn't believe in him as much as I do, I would have kept that section. I'd have been stubborn about it, but I wasn't at all. Immediately I saw the justice of it. And that was just maybe the major instance, but there were many. And I think again that his intuitions as an artist, you know, carried over from one genre to another. And they were very helpful to me.
Thank you so much.
I have to say it must have been a good instinct because, as I said, it's still there, even though you've taken a lot of it out of the text. I mean, I definitely went there and wondered about it. So, yeah. Let's see. James, I want to ask you, why a worm? Why did we start with a worm in the first place?
Oh, my God. I don't even know. Oh, well, the way I start all my books, really, is I start by drawing little pictures of characters and, you know, like doodling. And I'll draw a whole bunch of characters, and then I just look for the one that has the spark of life. And if it's got the spark of life, then I know that there's a story inside that character. And then I just put the character in a situation, and then the story writes itself.
Sid does.
Yeah,
well, which is a lot.
It's a very similar process to what I was describing earlier.
Yeah,
I didn't even know that was your process, but it rings a bell with me.
Yeah,
I always think that writing of any kind that knows where it's going too clearly at the beginning is bound to be pretty wooden because there's no sense of excitement or discovery on the part of the author, because he or she already knows what the conclusion is, and that's you know, and then so the characters tend to become stick figures rather than actually dynamic agents of their own.
Yeah.
I don't want to downgrade what Sid did, which is, you know, write a brilliant epic poem. But when you say that he wrote the story was complete in the drawings.
No, I know.
When I handed it
as soon as I said that, I thought big faux pas right there. Big faux pas.
I've never asked you if it bears the remotest resemblance to your notion of what the story is.
Well, there were points where you, in the editing, there were points where you, I thought, were maybe starting to go the wrong direction. And so I would say, this is what I think Worm Boy is feeling here.
Yeah, that's right.
And just every once in a while.
So it's also a dream. Am I right?
Well, I can't say.
So we can't say. But so that's the other thing I was interested in is like, oh, it's pretty.
I would say it's not a dream, but I would say it's dreamlike. But yeah.
Well, it could be a dream. And I feel like the reader has the opportunity to write part of this as well, because the reader can decide how much of this to take at all, you know, as a dream or as a, I don't know, story that's real.
I would just say it's like, it's just life condensed into a, you know, sort of in a some metaphorical way. So it seems dreamlike in the sense that looking back on life seems dreamlike. It doesn't make sense.
Well, I don't think that it's necessarily saying it's a dream, but it does open in a dream state, and it also refers to the dream at the end. And so to that extent, I thought it offered the reader the opportunity to see it that way. But I will do whatever you can.
Yeah, but I don't think he's waking up. I don't think he's waking up from this dream.
Well, no spoilers. Let's talk a little bit about the actual publication. So the cover is color, and then the pictures inside are black and white. And I wondered if you did any of these pages as color prints for any sort of use outside of the book. Do you ever, for publicity purposes, or like print up prints or anything like that?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it's certainly possible. Some of these pages would make great prints.
Yeah.
But no, I don't really make prints.
Okay. So just the cover was done with a color scheme, which is beautiful. I mean, I loved the colors on the cover.
Thank you.
It's beautiful and muted and kind of spring-like, which is cool. And then choosing the cover. So this is similar to one of the inside pictures, but it's not exactly the same. So I just wondered if you chose the cover and then changed it, or how that was done.
Oh, well, I drew the interior first, and then I looked through the interior for striking images that would make a good cover, and then mm-hmm. I redrew it.
Okay. I want to talk about the presence of God in this work. We are gods as we begin, and then there's this great point where, after a particularly close call, Worm Boy is not devoured, but saved by this other creature. I'm not going to go into detail, but he says, "Praise be to," and then there's an ellipsis, "something." And I liked that there was something present, but it was unnamed. I thought that was great. And I don't know if that's too specific a question, but do you remember writing that bit?
I do. And I knew that that James was as heathenish as I am a believer. I didn't want to impose any specific, because any good believer, I'm truly an agnostic. I don't know what the hell's going on, but I didn't want to impose any frame of reference that was alien to his.
Sure.
You could have. It wouldn't bother me.
No, I know it wouldn't. But I also thought it was truer to the effort to leave it a little ambiguous. Everything's ambiguous, you know. He keeps going up, but you don't know where that is.
Yeah. Sid, do you want to read from it just so that people can get a sense?
I've got the text here in front of me.
Wonderful. Okay, well, I had sort of chosen sort of a turn of events when his friends come into the picture and then rather quickly leave. Heat Indeed, I think it starts.
Heat Indeed, it wants a three look up, a tulip, proud and fiery as some dimly remembered autumn tree, or a beacon crucial to some old story. Without a word, his two friends now observe a vivid upward impulse. The very day seems to vibrate with their verve. What gives our worm boy pause? Yes, why does he lag behind? He can't quite figure. Isn't Muck and Flick's delight at aiming so high at hand for worm boy too? His chums bounce the flower stem to launch themselves up even farther. He cheers them on, the sound he makes a plain and simple vowel, but open, hearty. Then dark horror sweeps in, at first mere shadow, then quickly an awful raptor's talons. Wormboy's lusty shouts turn into shrieks that are partly rueful. Did he dream this attack? Muck and Flick fade into sky, going gray, it seems, in an instant.
Thank you very much. That seemed like such a turning point in the story, and it changes.
Well, it sends chills up my arms.
Right, and it changes everything, and we should, I don't know. James, do you want to describe the pictures that go with that section?
Sure. So, Worm Boy has just come out of the ground in the previous section. He's just come out of the ground and met his friends, these two fellow worms, Muck and Flick.
Which you have to be very careful when you say together on the radio.
Sorry. Sid chose the names. So they're just, meandering along, and one of them looks up and sees this beautiful tulip. And Worm Boy's friends happily climb up the stem, and then they start bouncing on it like a trampoline, and they're having the best time, and Worm Boy is just looking up at them, smiling, enjoying their and then this black wing shows up, and then these two talons come down and grab them, and Worm Boy screams with this ridiculous cartoonish tongue sticking out, and then the bird flies away with his friends while he watches in horror.
Right. And they fade into a sky gone gray, it seems, in an instant, which it does kind of give me chills.
Which is great, because I literally don't draw, there's nothing I've drawn in the sky indicating it's gone gray in any way at all. So that's the way his words, it's basically just blank white paper there for the sky. And and it's great the way he's imagined.
Yeah.
What my blank white paper represents.
And the other thing that he takes away from your drawing, if we may talk about you in the third person for a minute longer, Sid, is what gives our worm boy pause. I mean, I love that. I loved that there's just this kind of like moment, like, why isn't he following them up the tulip? Why isn't he playing with them? I mean, it's just fun. I think it's really a nice collaboration. I wanted to ask if you feel this is a book about friendship or responsibility, or am I overthinking it to think, or is it the hero's journey?
It's so many things.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, I really was just trying to express, it's better. I always find it better not to say, but feelings I had about life and mortality. And I find that I don't know what the book is about when I begin, and I'm just exploring. And so meanings emerge as I work on it. And then it was just great to see what Sid imagined those meanings might be. So I don't want to put it any of it into words, because Sid has done such a good job of putting it into words.
Right.
I would say not a meaning, but an impulse. That's the ever upward
journey
of Reform boy.
And you're right to think of it in religious terms, I think.
I think that, at various points, he could give in to despair very easily, as one could in our contemporary social and political context.
Yeah.
But that's kind of the easy way out. Anybody can do that. Oh, everything's terrible. I give up. But I like the notion at the end that even though he doesn't know how it's going to work out, his impulse is still to try making something positive of this extraordinary adventure that he's been on, including riding in the maw of a fish and, so on.
I find, just looking at it today, amazing parallels to the situation we're in right now, even though we wrote it the year or two before, in that, okay, so he's like in hibernation, like we're all, quarantining ourselves or whatever, or trying to socially distance. And then he has this joyous moment where he finally gets to reunite with his friends, but then, disaster strikes right away. And it's like, that's what we're afraid is going to happen if we reunite with our friends now.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really interesting, isn't it? I have not thought of it that way, but it is. It's really interesting. I had a question about this time period. Let's go to that next, since we're already talking about it. I wonder how you're finding this period of time as far as your work. Are you able to work? Is it more onerous now because of COVID and maybe, whatever your political reactions are to this time period? Or do you find that very generative?
I'm sure that's the question James would like to answer.
It is, because I've been doing fantastic. I've been getting so much work done. I had when the governor called the shutdown, and then suddenly my whole family was home with me. I had like 3 days where I couldn't work, and I was really like sort of panicked. I'd never be able to work again, and then I was like, well, I have to. And so I got to work, and I found it was easy. In fact, easier with my family here than with them gone.
Interesting.
Because I'm just so lonely when they're not here. I spend the whole day being sad that I'm alone. And I found it actually a little easier to work with people walking around the house.
Wow. Interesting.
I didn't know that I could work that way.
Huh. Are they pretty respectful of your privacy where your
office
is?
They totally leave me alone. Yeah.
Okay. All right. That's great.
I too have found it extraordinarily generative. My kids are, I've got 5 kids and 7 grandkids, and my kids are a lot older than James's. And the hardest thing about this whole episode in our life has been my separation from the children and the grandchildren. All 7 grandchildren live in Vermont, after all. I'm blessed that way. But as a retiree married to a retiree and very happily married, thank God. I can't imagine what people in contentious marriages are doing nowadays. But I just found that there wasn't a whole lot else to do. Being a writer, I guess I might as well write. And all of a sudden, I'm not the one to judge the quality, but I wrote a 14-page sequence of the coronavirus sequence called Animate Objects. And I just decided, and I can't remember why, I looked at various things around the house to which I was pretty much confined if I wasn't in the woods. And I said, well, everything in the house has a little story behind it. The grandfather clock that was made in Emmaus, PA by my great-grandfather, this old schooner made completely out of cattle horn, a nest that with a little fragment of robin shell still left in it that has a story, and so on and so forth. And I just and I wrote that. I must have written it in as many days. It's 14 parts, and then I sent it out, and it was accepted within 48 hours, which
Wow.
is absolutely extraordinary in this day of editorial response, which tends to be closer to geological than chronological. But the American Journal of Poetry, which is an excellent online magazine, took it and published it within a month. And I And I kept going. I mean, I was writing an awful lot. And then all of a sudden I realized, you know, I just published a book in 2019. I knew my publisher wasn't going to want to publish another one now. So I had an immense amount of, you know, well-published material. So I've, in the last 3 weeks, I've been, you know, with some, not without pain, I've been lopping away a certain poetic material to make this a decent manuscript. And happily, it's been accepted sight unseen, but it won't come out till 1923, which poses its own problems, because I have a poem, for example, called Alone at 77.
2023, you mean?
Should I change this to Alone at 80? Because that's what I'll be when it comes out. I don't know. It's posed its own challenges, but it's also been that's been interesting, too, to see, you know, what was the arc of my concern during the period I wrote that.
Yeah. We had a very difficult time finding a publisher for The Exquisite Triumph.
I was going to ask about the publishing journey. Yeah, go. Sorry.
Well, for instance, they would say things like this. This publisher said they you know, loved it, were moved to tears, could not publish it. Like, well, So multiple people said they loved it and couldn't publish it. They're like, I don't know how to sell a book like this. What is this?
You get any rejection that wasn't complimentary. You know, the old encouraging rejection that aspiring writers could paper their walls with? We got a lot of that.
That's very common now, especially with the younger editors. They always praise you when they reject you now. They didn't used to do that in the 80s or 90s. In the 80s or 90s, they reject you and tell you it was Now they reject you and tell you it's genius. I think they just don't want to hurt our feelings.
Well, I kind of like the tough love approach, because at least it makes sense. If they say they loved it and they cried, then it's just so frustrating to not get any other feedback. Like, did they give you any explanation other than, like, how do we market it? Is that what they were saying?
Oh, no, that was it. Yeah.
Inevitably, how can we market this
thing? Yeah. Terrible. Wow. Okay, so let's give credit then to the Word Galaxy Press, which is an imprint of Able Muse Press. So how did you find this? Had you worked with them before?
I knew of Able Muse because, you know, a lot of the poetry here is somewhat formal, and that's the press that's known for publishing formal poetry. They also have a magazine called Able Muse, and it's not exclusively dedicated to conventional forms or to rhyme meter, what have you, but it leans in that direction. And I thought, and a favorite ex-student of mine, one of my first creative writing students at Dartmouth College, in fact, had just published a really terrific book. His name is Alfred Nickel. And he said it to me, you know, we've stayed friends for almost 50 years. And he sent it to me, and I read it, and I was very impressed. And I said, well, why not try them? And they were encouraging right from the start. In fact, well, they kind of encouraged us to enter it in a contest.
No, it's the opposite. So a weird thing that a lot of poetry publishers do is they have these contests where you enter your work, and then they have, like, I don't know, like a celebrity poet pick the winner. I don't know. And I was really leery of these contests, but since we weren't having any luck finding a publisher, Sid said, why don't we enter this contest? And we did enter the contest, and then they wrote to us and said, are you sure you want to enter this in the contest? Because we'll just publish it.
That's right. Yeah, that's relatively useful.
But like, you go to the submission guidelines, and they'll all say, don't submit. you know, enter the contest, don't submit, or submit only between like the 12th of June and the 20th of June. I'm like, what?
Yeah. Right. That's interesting.
I'm used to comics where every editor knows who I am. So it doesn't matter what their submission guidelines are. They'll look at what I want to show them no matter what.
Right.
So it was weird in poetry. They don't know who I am.
Yeah, but they know who Sid is.
Yeah, so that probably helped.
Yeah, I had a friend. This press will remain nameless because I thought it was kind of questionable. But I had a friend who submitted an essay collection to a press and was told that if she submitted it to their contest, they would she would win. So she submitted it to their contest and she won. So that went the other way.
Again. Right, right.
So
I never heard of such a thing. That's interesting.
Yeah. It was. Yeah, it was interesting. What is each of you working on now? Let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, I have six books coming out in a 6-month period.
Wow.
And two of them already came out. Johnny Boo Finds a Clue and Glark Patrol on the Bad Planet came out. And next week, Monkey versus Robot, The Complete Epic comes out, which is the 20th anniversary of Monkey versus Robot. So it includes the first Monkey versus Robot book, the second one, and then I've written and drawn a third one that has never seen print before. And so they're all together in one book. And the original was black and white, and now I've colored it. And then this book, The Exquisite Triumph of Worm Boy. And then it's interesting. In 1 year, I got we did this book, which is a pretty small publisher, a small little book deal. And I also got the biggest book deal I ever got in my life, which a new series with Scholastic called Banana Fox. So Banana Fox and the Secret Sour Society comes out January 5th.
Wow.
And then another Johnny Boo book, Johnny Boo and the Silly Blizzard, comes out in February. So, but that's all work that's done. I'm still working on other books. I've just finished up the second Banana Fox book for Scholastic, and I just have to do the finished cover for that. And I'm coloring the second Glork Patrol book called Glork Patrol Takes a Bath.
Wow.
right now. And both of those books are books that I did the rough draft during the state lockdown. And now it's, I don't know, 6 months later,
mm-hmm.
5 months, and I'm finishing that.
Oh my God.
So that's, I feel like it's pretty
that's
productive.
That's fast. That seems fast. Yeah.
But I realized recently that I've put out between one and four books a year for the last like 30 years. And it doesn't seem sustainable, but but now I have six books coming.
Yeah, I wouldn't question. I think I would just go with it. How about you, Sid? What are you working on?
I'm beginning to feel completely idle.
Sorry.
Here I was patting myself on the back for being so damn productive in the last year or so. Well, as I say, I've been shaping this poetry book, but I may have taken as many as 25 pretty well published poems out of the manuscript, and I suppose they'll go toward a subsequent one if I can get it out within my lifespan. But I decided, it's probably not a good idea to keep generating poems. And as you know, Sheila, I've done a number of, I hate this term, but so-called creative nonfiction.
You like narrative nonfiction. You said you like
or lyrical nonfiction, anything. Creative nonfiction just sounds so made up by the Associated Writing Program or something. But
I like lyrical nonfiction. That sounds great.
In fact, a couple of days ago up here, I started an essay on what to make of the influx of people buying property sight unseen in Vermont and fleeing. Many of them probably won't last through one mud season. I mean, we had something similar after 9/11, not at this scale, but I ran into a woman up here, and this is the end of the road. And she was completely bewildered on a dirt road. And she said that she'd bought a place in this neighborhood and she couldn't find it. I said, you never seen it before? She said, no, I bought it from the advertisement. I don't think she's going to last. But at any rate, I don't want to tell you where that essay is going because I'm not really sure myself. But it kind of got me going on the idea of doing another collection of essays. I love to write essays. So, it'll be a nice departure, a familiar something for the moment new.
Yeah, right.
My dad was a newspaper editor and reporter, And but his favorite thing to write were was lyrical nonfiction, which he would write these stories for the paper just about, you know, some observation of the season or something. And I'd never heard that word lyrical nonfiction till today, but I just realized that's what my dad wrote.
Yeah. That's a good,
I remember when I was a kid, he wrote this really beautiful lyrical piece about the neighbor's cat. And I was just so mad it wasn't about our cat. So he'd put that in the paper. He was the editor, so he could put whatever he wanted in there.
That's so funny. Let's see. I wanted to ask if either of you wants to talk about what you've read lately that you like. Just a couple titles maybe that you could recommend to listeners.
The stuff that I read isn't anything like my own work. Right now I'm reading Harrow the Ninth, about a lesbian necromancer in space.
Uh-huh.
There's not really any lesbianism in it.
Can't they come up with something more original than that? I mean, that old plowing the same old road. I've been reading a lot of poetry, but I just finished Marilyn Robinson's fourth book in the tetralogy. It's called Jack, the Gilead Tetralogy. And I just finished that. Because anything she writes, I'll read. I was not as smitten by Jack as I was by the other three books, but still, in all, I think she could write a shopping list and I'd read it. then as I think you know from our prior program, Shel, I have this really interesting correspondence with the Vermont poet Tony Whedon, who spends the winters down in Georgia and has been
Darien, Georgia.
Yeah, and so we swap a lot. There's a poet named Stephen Bluestone, lives in Brooklyn. Wrote a wonderful book called The Painted Clock, and he's doing a whole series of poems based on that, in the voices of historical figures, everybody from Carrie Nation to the Earl of Rochester, and they're really brilliant. And we swap those, and then longtime conspirators, a wonderful poet named Fleeta Brown. She was the poet laureate of Delaware, and we've become very close friends, though we've only seen each other, I think, three times in our lives. We just hit it off, you know, and it's a completely pen pal thing. But I can say I love this woman without thinking that it's an exaggeration at all. She's got a new book coming out, and I've been reading the manuscript and making very few, but more such suggestions as I can.
Wonderful.
I've been reading the Earthsea series to my son Oliver, who's just about to turn 13. So he still lets me read to him every night.
Isn't that nice?
I don't know how much longer he'll let me do that, but we're on like book five right now of that. And I've been reading, I discovered this science fiction author, Doris Presercia, who wrote just for a few years in the 80s, but did like 10 books or something. So I've been working my way through her books, and they're just fantastic. It's hard to say exactly what's good about them. What's good about them is that they're odd. You know, so she has her own way of writing and her own kind of storytelling that I haven't encountered anywhere else. So it doesn't matter to me if she's the best, because it's so interesting.
Yeah.
And they've all, like, each one of her books has like been printed once, you know, and then never reprinted. So I buy the old dusty paperbacks, which they're not expensive because no one's particularly interested in her work, except for people who like it.
It's fun to discover someone who's got a lot of work and realize, like, on the first one you read, oh, wow, this is really cool.
Yeah.
You mentioned about reading to your son. I'll just tell a quick story, and that is that my son was 7 when the first Harry Potter came out, and I read it to him. And doing all the accents and everything. And then, so every time one came out, I read them to him. And when the last one came out, he was a senior in high school and he let me read it to him.
Oh, nice.
It was super fun. Super fun. He's a very nice guy.
When Harry Potter came out, my wife would order, you know, when it was, they'd pre-order it. And when it came, and she would not let either of our two youngest daughters look at it until we got in the car to go to Maine. It's an 8-hour trip, and they say, okay, go. And every so often they would say, where are you? Where are you? I'm on page 82. Wait a minute. I'll catch up. We never got any of this, are we there yet kind of thing at all. Yeah. It was a magic.
That's fun. That's really fun. I just have one last question for you guys. I wanted to ask about advice for writers who want to collaborate across artistic media and genre. And I don't know how to say that, so that's what I came up with. Artistic media and genre. I don't know if that's right. But collaborating, you know, writing and art, or, you know, whatever. What might you say?
Well, I suggest very strongly that you befriend a brilliant young cartoonist and get him to send you a whole bunch of James and I have also collaborated on I think you were there when we did The Seagull and the Star, which also involved musical competition.
That's right. That's right.
I don't know.
That was commissioned by
the Vermont Contemporary Musical Ensemble.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yes, right. Correct. That's the one I saw at the Black Box Theater.
I guess the only thing I can say is, you know, think about it. You know, very few of us, especially people who are graduates of MFA programs, either in the arts or otherwise, we tend to have a kind of a tunnel vision. I think I did. You know, I thought I was extremely Catholic in my taste because I'd written a novel and a few books of essays in addition to poetry. It had never dawned on me to do something like cartoons or with music, or I mean, maybe with music it had occurred to me it might be nice if somebody came and volunteered to set some poems to music, but as somebody did. But it was such a eye and soul opening experience to start collaborating with James, and I would just urge people to imagine collaborations of whatever sort with other arts.
Wonderful.
I guess I started collaborating originally musically with people because I wanted to write songs, but I couldn't play an instrument, so I had to collaborate with musicians. Uh-huh. Since then, I've taught myself to play piano, so I can kind of muddle through a little bit. The thing that I would, the hardest thing about collaborating is finding somebody who won't give up. I like to work with people who I know are not going to give up.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So, but that can be really hard starting out if it's easy for me and Sid, because we've both have, you know, long careers and we have shown ourselves we can finish projects, right? And so we can look at each other and say, that's a guy who can finish a project. But if you don't have a body of work behind you and you want to collaborate with someone who doesn't have a body of work behind them, neither of you knows if you can even do it at all.
Right.
So a lot of people try to collaborate and it just all falls apart. It happens with someone wants to start, make a video game with their friends, and and it takes a lot of work to do something like that. And it all falls apart and nothing gets completed.
Right. But, or one person carries the load and then everybody else is mad. And,
right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that happens even to people who are like, I'm going to write a novel, you know, and they write a few pages and then they stop. If you can't finish anything on your own, don't try to collaborate with somebody else.
Good point.
Well said.
That's a really good point.
I don't want to discourage anybody from creating. You know, like if you've had trouble finishing something, just try something smaller.
Very good. All right. Listen, I'm going to just mention again, the name of the book is The Exquisite Triumph of Worm Boy by James Kochalka and Sidney Lee, both former Vermont laureates, and published by Word Galaxy Press. it's been a real pleasure to read this beautiful book and to speak to you today. Thank you both.
Oh, thank you.
Well, thanks as usual, Sheila. It's always a delight, and it's great to see you, James, if only virtually.
Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
That was fun.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was a combined interview with two Vermont authors, James Kachalka and Sidney Lee, about their new collection, The Exquisite Triumph of Worm Boy, a rather extraordinary cartoon and poetry book published by Word Galaxy. This week I have a couple of Write the Book prompts to share. The first one is thanks to the generosity of James Kachalka, and inspired by the way that he and Sidney Lee worked together on Worm Boy. I'm going to post, as I do every week actually, post the cover of Worm Boy on the podcast site, and you can use the cartoon that James Kachalka and Sidney Lee chose for the cover of their book as an inspiration. Have a look at the cartoon and see what words come to mind. Maybe try to write a poem or a short scene. Maybe a brief lyrical essay. And then the second Write the Book prompt is that maybe you might want to have a look at the book Philomath, and I'm going to talk about that a little later when I talk about the pandemic. But maybe you'll find inspiration in that book, Philomath, which is affiliated with the organization TriviaRelief.org. Whatever you choose to write, good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. Next week on Write the Book, I'll share an interview with Deborah Horwitz, who is a co-editor of Decoding Your Cat. The ultimate experts explain common cat behaviors and reveal how to prevent or change unwanted ones. Once again, it's time for my pandemic statement. It's getting cooler outside. Be safe, be careful, wear a mask, avoid crowds. It's a hard time for most people, including for authors. So do try to find the books that have come out, even as book tours are being canceled. I hope that you're able to read and to write. Keep in mind that the archives of the show offer weekly writing prompts to help you in your work. To that end, I was recently made aware of something, an organization called Trivia Relief. It benefits cultural institutions and individuals in the creative community that are suffering as a result of the coronavirus crisis. If you want more information, you can go to TriviaRelief.org. They have a kind of cool book called Philomath, the creation of Wim Vanderhoof, a Texan expat living in London. A book of trivia that provides entertainment to readers and to support the creative individuals who brighten our lives. So you can find more information at TriviaRelief.org. We are getting close to Election Day. You still have time to make a plan for voting. Go online and look into what is required in your state, and then do that thing that is required, please. It's important. Collectively, we do have great power. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. Be sure to tell all your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. You can also find us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and pretty much, I think, wherever you get your podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, which is shelaughswithoutus.com. That is just a mnemonic to help you learn how to spell my name. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well, have a great week, and vote.